Hong Kong Advanced Level Examination. Use of English. Section A. Listening Test 2009. Instructions to candidates. You should have on your desk a question answer book. Do not open it until you are told to do so. I repeat. Do not open the question answer book until you are told to do so. Now write your candidate number in the space provided on page 1 of your question answer book. Now check through your question answer book and make sure it has no missing pages. Look for the words end of test on the last page. Now stick your barcode labels in the spaces provided on pages 1, 3, 5, and 7. You are reminded that all examination materials will be played once only. The test is divided into three parts. You should use a pencil to write your answers for all three parts. At the end of the examination, when you are told to stop, put down your pencil and close your question answer book. You may not leave the examination room until you are instructed to do so at the end of the examination session. Put your hand up now if you have any difficulties. The test is about to begin. Keep your earphones on until you are told to take them off. Now look at page 3 of your question answer book. Introduction. Situation. You are Chris Lee, a sixth form student. Your class at school is doing a project about what the environment will be like by the mid-21st century. As part of the research for the project, you and two classmates visited an exhibition in the Science Museum called Gaia Vision. There, two guides named Roy and Rachel explained the principles of the Gaian view of the environment and climate change. You are required to make notes and do various tasks based on a recording you made of the visit and some visual materials you were shown at the exhibition. Part 1. In this part, you'll hear the guides giving your group some general information about the beliefs of Gaia followers. You'll now have 2.5 minutes to familiarize yourself with the note headings for Part 1. At the end of Part 1, you'll have 2 minutes to tidy up your answers. Thank you.
Okay, Chris has got the recorder working. Well done.
The guides are late, Joe. They were supposed to be here 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, and I bet they come by bus. Not very environmentally friendly, eh, Sam?
Yeah, and I bet the bus is air-conditioned. That taxi we took from the ferry pier was like an oven.
We should really have come by train, you know. That would have been the greenest mode of public transport.
Yeah, but Chris was late as usual. Ah, here they come. Now that really is green.
Hello. I'm Roy, one of your guides for today. And my fellow rider is Rachel.
Hi.
Hi.
And this is the Gaia Express, fully pedal-powered and pollutant-free.
You must be Sam, Joe and Chris from Tyrell Secondary School.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, let's just padlock this to the railings and we'll head straight for the animation centre. Mm-hmm. On the way, we'll tell you all you need to know about the founder of Gaia Theory, the theory on which this whole exhibition is based.
Right.
Gaia Theory was started in the 1970s and the main founder was an Englishman called James Lovelock. Mm-hmm. That's James as in James Bond, love as in love at first sight, and lock as in door lock.
Okay.
Lovelock is one word, remember?
All right.
Lovelock is many things. First and foremost, he is an independent scientist. And I stress, independent. There are no A's in independent, Sam.
Okay, sorry.
Because he's not a conventional scientist, he is, of course, an environmentalist as well. And don't forget to put the N before the M. That's it, Chris. And he's also an author. I hope you've read at least one of the 4 books he's written.
We will.
And his academic background is extraordinary. So you should also make a note of the fact that he's a researcher. And the range of his research is quite amazing. And that he's an honorary doctor at several universities.
Honorary doctor? Sorry, how do you spell honorary?
H-O-N-O-R-A-R-Y.
Right.
Oh, and don't forget to write doctor. Got it?
Yep.
Okay. I've mentioned that he's written 4 books, but his latest one is called The Revenge of Gaia. It's his most disturbing book because it shows us how our environmental awareness is very limited. In fact, Dr. Lovelock is considered to be a leader in environmental awareness.
That's right.
His thoughts have changed the way many scientists, and indeed non-scientists, think.
Hmm.
One other thing that may surprise you is that he's a champion of clean nuclear energy.
Nuclear energy, but that stuff's dangerous, isn't it?
Mm-mm.
Not if it's handled correctly, Sam. And the belief that nuclear energy is dangerous is, I have to say, a very conventional one.
That's right, and challenging conventional beliefs is part of what Gaia's all about.
What do you mean by conventional beliefs?
Well, let's take a fundamental one to start with. That is, that life evolved on Earth because the conditions were right. Now, by the conditions were right, I mean things like the temperature, breathable air, the soil where living creatures could grow and survive, were all perfectly balanced. And because the conditions were right, life was able to form and grow.
So how does Gaia believe differently?
Well, to put it succinctly, Gaia followers believe that all living things create these conditions.
Eh?
Well, all living things, trees, plants, animals, humans, whatever, breathes, lives, dies and decays, fills the air with different gases. And so they create these conditions.
Yes, and that leads you to the second Gaian belief, which is that humans are participants on Earth. participants, Joe, not participles. And put that in the right-hand column. Whereas conventional belief is that humans are passengers on Earth, just like we are on a bus or a train.
Now, if you're a conventional thinker, it's easy to believe that humans change to suit the conditions of the Earth at various times, that is.
Mm.
Yet humans have lived through ice ages, droughts, all sorts over the centuries.
But Gaian belief stresses human activity much more. It says human activity changes the conditions, and now it's changing the conditions dramatically.
Ah.
It's stamping a great big carbon footprint all over the world.
Yeah. Well, don't worry, says the conventional believer. The Earth is too strong for humans to hurt it. Look how long it's survived. Yes, it's just too strong.
But Gaians believe the Earth is now weak. Humans, using too much energy, using up too many resources, have made it weaker than ever before.
But will the planet survive?
Well, this is one issue on which conventional and Gaian believers agree.
Yeah.
That the Earth will heal itself eventually.
Mm-hmm.
That the important difference is that while it may heal itself, conventional belief is sure that civilization will survive.
Right.
Whereas us Gaians are afraid that only a few humans will survive.
No civilization, no global community. Mm-hmm. Just a few humans living where they can.
Really? No cities and no infrastructure?
Nope.
Only a few survivors?
Mm-hmm.
No way. That's pure science fiction, Roy.
Not necessarily.
What a terrible prospect. Just awful. I don't know what to say.
Ah, here we are at the animation centre. Sorry, no air conditioning as it's environmentally unfriendly.
Great.
Now, take one of these each and have a look at it. It's the Daisy World worksheet.
Daisy World?
Yep, Daisy World is a planet about the same size as Earth. Now, for the first four pictures, you have to fill in the missing words, OK?
OK.
So, Daisy World is orbiting a sun, just like ours. In the beginning, it's entirely covered with equal numbers of dormant, that is, not active, seeds of black and white flowers.
Mm.
This is the black daisy. With its darker petals, it's better at absorbing light for photosynthesis than the white daisy.
Let me just write that down. Absorbing light. OK, I've got it.
This is the white daisy. Its white petals are better at...
reflecting light.
Uh-huh, you've got it. Reflecting light than the black daisy. So it can avoid overheating and dying.
Uh-huh.
Now, gradually, the temperature of Daisy World warms up as time passes.
Yeah.
And we're talking millions of years here, by the way. And with the increased temperature, the seeds can develop into plants with flowers.
The black and white daisies.
That's right. Now, let's see if you can get the stages of what happens to Daisy World in the correct order.
Yeah.
I've numbered the first one already to make it easier.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, there are an equal number of black and white daisies to start with, and the temperature is an even 50 degrees.
Yep.
However, the black daisies are more efficient at photosynthesis, that is, converting light into energy, than the white daisies are, and so they outcompete them. You see, there are 8 black daisies now, and only 6 white ones, and the temperature has gone up to about 60 degrees.
Hmm.
Now, watch as the number increases and keep an eye on the temperature too.
So you can see that because the black daisies are so good at absorbing light, which is what gave them the advantage in the first place, there are so many of them that they're heating up the entire planet.
Ah.
You see, and the temperature heads up into the 90s. See? Look at the scale.
Oh, yeah. It's really hot now.
But due to the high temperatures, the white daisies are gradually able to outcompete the black, since they're better at reflecting away the sun's light, and so stop themselves from overheating and dying out.
And they bring the temperature back down again.
That's right, to well below 50 degrees, say 25 or so. You can label that picture number 4.
Okay.
But the white daisies are so successful and spread so much that the temperature goes down even further. let's say, to 10 degrees. And, of course, that means only one thing.
Aha! The black daisies are able to take advantage of the low temperatures and fight back against the white daisies. See, there are 5 black daisies again, and more to come, and the temperature is back to just below 50 degrees.
Yeah.
Now, soon there'll be equal numbers of black and white daisies, just like at the beginning.
And so the cycle goes on, with the black daisies and the white daisies taking it in turns to spread and die off again. And this shows us what Gaia is all about. Plants and organisms regulate the planet, and the planet, or the planet's temperature, regulates the growth of the plants and organisms. Got the grip of Gaia yet?
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay, time to regulate our bodies with a bit of refreshment, I think. Let's have a drink and a rest in the coffee shop.
Yeah, good idea.
That's the end of part one. You'll now have 2 minutes to tidy up what you've written. Part 2. In this part, you'll hear the guides talking about the benefits and drawbacks for the environment of the use of different energy sources. You now have 2 minutes to familiarize yourself with the note headings for Part 2. At the end of Part 2, you'll have 2.5 minutes to tidy up your answers. Thank you.
So, what happens when the regulation pattern is disturbed? Let's have a look at this flowchart showing the sequence of events and how each of them impacts on the planet's climate. You can note down the main points on the blank flowchart we've given you. The left-hand column shows the sequence of events, while the right emphasizes some detail of the event which may contribute directly to the temperature rising. Feedback-related details, we've labeled it. So, let's start on the left with the heat rises. You can put that in the first box at the top. That's it, Joe. The heat rises. Now, what that leads to is more ice melts. That is, ice at the poles, the North and the South poles.
There's always stuff about that happening on the news.
And there'll be even more as the years go by. But what's important about ice?
It keeps your drinks cool.
I mean in planetary turf, Sam.
All right, well, I suppose it reflects sunlight because it's white.
Correct.
Full marks, Sam. And if it melts, there's less ice to reflect sunlight. Now, put that in the topmost box on the right-hand side of the chart. Well, it's more of an oval shape, really. Less ice to reflect sunlight. That's it. Now, if you follow the arrows from the oval, you'll see they lead back to the heat rises, which is the starting point of our flow, so to speak. But let's go down to the third box in the left-hand column. The melting of the ice leads to, and you can note this down, more open water and land. And what's important about that, Sam? No wisecracks, please.
Yes, not this time.
Okay. Open water and land absorb sunlight. They absorb it rather than reflect it.
Hooray! And so,
well done.
Round we go to the heat rises again. Okay, back to the left-hand column. Now, with more land and water, weather patterns change. And you can write weather patterns change in the fourth box. There may be heavy rainfall or drought in some areas. No need to write that down, Joe. I'm just giving examples. So, why are weather patterns so critical?
Well, I suppose because they keep the environment... they keep it...
Stable. I think stable is the word you're looking for.
Yes, that's right.
And we can say that changing weather patterns mean the environment is not stable. Deserts expand, forests contract, and all of that just adds to the rising heat. Now, the next stage in the process is that the permafrost melts.
The permafrost?
Yes. That's the frost that keeps things permanently frozen in areas like Alaska or Siberia. If it melts, greenhouse gases are released. You know what a greenhouse gas is, don't you?
Yes, one that adds to global warming.
Right.
Anyway, the release of these greenhouse gases leads us back once again to our starting point of rising heat.
Phew, that's a lot to write down.
Yeah.
Give me a moment or two.
Take your time.
What's this mountain thing supposed to represent? It looks like the model in that old movie. What was it? Close Encounters.
This, Sam, is an attempt to represent the amount of waste produced by our most popular source of energy, the burning of coal and oil. Now, if you are able to freeze all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, well, that is, make it solid, it would create a mountain 1 mile high and 12 miles in circumference.
Wow.
That's right.
I beg your pardon?
You heard me right. That's a mile straight up and 12 if you want to walk around the base of it. Pretty big, huh?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, so a main disadvantage of coal and oil as an energy source would be they create carbon dioxide.
Yep, that's right. Or CO2. The next thing you ought to note down is that it's inefficient.
Right.
And it's inefficient because it costs a lot to produce. And we have to use too much to create too little energy.
Inefficient. Is that one N and two Fs?
Uh-huh, that's right. And finally, as I've pointed out with this exhibit, waste disposal is difficult. Just how do you dispose of a mountain of carbon? There's simply no way to get rid of that amount of waste.
What about natural gas? Isn't that a better alternative?
Well, theoretically, yes. But natural gas contains methane.
Mm.
Oh, that's M-E-T-H-A-N-E.
Right.
Okay, and the problem with methane is that it's a greenhouse gas, a very strong one, in fact.
But we burn the methane, don't we? That's how we get the flame when we're cooking.
Yeah, that's true. But the problem is, Sam, gas leaks.
Mm.
Every time you turn on the cooker, a tiny bit of gas leaks into the air.
Yeah, but only a tiny bit.
Mm.
Yeah, but a tiny bit multiplied by millions, billions even.
That's right.
Yeah, you just think about how many people turn on a gas stove or cooker every day, or sometimes two or three times a day.
Yeah.
Well, the leakage is not so tiny anymore. And in fact, it's around 4% of the total.
All right then, wind power. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? I mean, I've seen the windmill on Llama Island.
And what a triumph that is.
Mm.
Unfortunately, though, the first problem is too many windmills are needed to generate enough energy to meet a country's requirements. The UK, for example, would need about 276,000 windmills to satisfy its needs.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's right. Then, of course, the wind doesn't always blow. It's not blowing at all today, for example.
Mm.
In fact, in general, the wind blows only about 25% of the time.
What happens when it isn't blowing?
Problem number three. Power stations must stand by. And, of course, to keep a power station on standby, you need to burn coal, and at a much less efficient rate. A further problem is that windmills ruin or spoil the scenery. I mean, one here or there is fine, but in some parts of Europe, the sight of row upon row of windmills has ruined the scenery as effectively, and indeed more extensively, than conventional power stations.
Mm.
Hmm. There's always solar power. Energy produced from sunlight. That wouldn't spoil the landscape.
Yeah, I
agree. But solar cells, that's C-E-L-L-S, by the way.
Right.
They're very expensive to produce.
What are solar cells?
They're what you store solar energy in, and they cost a lot of money. Also, like the wind, the sun doesn't always shine, especially in northern regions.
That's right.
Yeah, I come from England, and sometimes it seems as if the sun doesn't shine for months at a time. Yeah, this leads to a third problem. Well, there's simply no place to store large amounts of solar energy at the moment.
What about the solar cells?
Well, I'm talking about storing large amounts of energy. The science will take decades to develop to the point where we can store and use solar energy efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't have that time.
Hey, what's that weird-looking car? Looks like something out of a fairground.
That, Sam, is our hydro buggy. And it could be the car of the future.
Mm.
The car has a special battery which uses electricity to make hydrogen gas from water. That's on the roof, you see.
Up there.
Yeah. Okay. So the battery makes hydrogen, but what's that wire running out of the back of the buggy into the ground?
That's an electricity charger.
A charge?
No, a charger.
Oh.
You see, you drive around all day using hydrogen. Then, when you park it at home, you plug the charger into a special socket in the garage, reverse the car battery, and use the hydrogen in your car to make electricity.
Electricity to power your home. What a great idea.
Exactly. The advantages of the hydro buggy is that A, it's pollution free. All the exhaust fumes are simply water, nothing more. And B, it can be used to generate electricity. Just think about it. All the cars in a given country, say the United States, all able to make electricity.
Wow.
No more need for great big ugly power stations.
That sounds fantastic.
It certainly does.
It certainly makes me feel a lot less anxious about the future.
There's just one problem, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. By the time we've got our act together and built a hydrogen infrastructure to make such a scheme viable, we'll all be dead. Well, most of us.
That's the end of part two. You now have 2.5 minutes to tidy up your notes. Part 3. In this part, you'll hear the guides talking about the Gaian ideas for how the human race can deal with the coming environmental crisis. You now have 2 minutes to familiarize yourself with the note headings for Part 3. At the end of Part 3, you'll have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers.
I get the feeling that Gaians don't really have much time for a lot of the more popular green ideas.
Green is often the colour of corruption and mould, Sam.
Yeah.
Old ideas that have gone rotten.
Yep, like those that many people have about nuclear energy, Sam.
Oh, yeah?
But as far as energy sources go, Gaians really favour the nuclear option.
That's right.
Well, it's clean, produces the minimum of waste, and offers the most potential. But at the other end of the scale is wind power. As we've explained, this is virtually useless when it comes to providing countrywide power, although it may still be useful for small-scale purposes. Solar energy is marginally better than wind power, but it's still too expensive at this stage.
What about natural gas?
Well, Joe, I put natural gas in the middle of the scale. It's certainly not as crazy as burning oil and coal, but with the leakage problems we've mentioned, it's hardly the best option at this moment in time. Now I've missed one, haven't I?
Hydrogen?
Oh yes, hydrogen. Well, with a bit of research and some substantial funding, who knows? Hydrogen could be the answer to all our problems. Currently, though, I'd say it was 2 on our scale,
right. Bearing
in mind what I said about nuclear power.
But nobody's going to opt for nuclear power, are they? I mean, not after all the problems it's had.
All energy sources have their problems, Sam. Nuclear power, in our view, has had a raw deal as far as that's concerned. I think the main reason why nuclear power is not so popular is that it's confused with nuclear war. Of course, a nuclear war would be horrific. And everyone knows about the Hiroshima bomb. But nuclear power is not the same as nuclear weapons.
No,
absolutely
for sure.
Absolutely not, no.
A second reason for deriding nuclear power is that there have been some serious accidents. Accidents which got a lot of media coverage and which were used to scare people, in some cases unreasonably. We've all heard of Chernobyl. And I'm not saying that that wasn't a terrible accident, just that it should be viewed in the context of accidents involving more conventional power sources, which are perhaps less high profile.
Yeah. Mm.
Another point worth making is that the media has demonised nuclear power.
Absolutely.
Demonised?
Yes, that's one word, demon. D-E-M-O-N, mm-hmm. with I-Z-E-D at the end. Not demon eyes, just like Hellboy.
All right, okay.
It means made nuclear power seem evil.
Mm.
And when I say the media, I don't just mean newspapers, I mean writers of books and filmmakers with their stories of nuclear holocaust.
But what about waste disposal issues? That's a big problem for nuclear energy, isn't it?
You've hit on the fourth reason there, Sam. Concerns about waste disposal. Well, let me assure you, the reality is if we used nuclear power stations to produce the same amount of energy as all the carbon fuels we burn each year, we would have a 16-meter cube of waste to wow. deal with, as opposed to the mountain of carbon Rachel told you about earlier.
16 meters? That's amazing.
Sure is. All right, this next animation shows the predictions which a group of scientists made in 1988 about how the climate may change.
Hmm.
Now, can you just take one of these graph sheets each? Okay,
yeah.
And has everyone got a ruler?
Yep.
Okay, if not, try and draw as straight as you can.
Okay.
Now, follow my instructions about what to put on the sheet. What I want you to do is draw three lines showing three different climate predictions or climate scenarios.
Okay. Here, you take this one, Chris.
Okay. Now look at the first graph. The x-axis tells you the year and the y-axis the number of degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I want you to follow the x-axis along the line indicating zero and find the cross above 1980.
Got it.
Good. Now draw a line from the cross down to the corner where the two axes meet at minus one.
Okay.
Right. Now that shows you the rise from the mid-1800s to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go back to 1980, our starting point. Now from the cross, draw the predicted continuation of the scientists' slow rise, what they call the lower scenario. By 2100, if temperatures were to follow this slow rise, they should be about halfway between 0 and 1 degree.
Right. Okay.
Right. Now I want you to draw the line representing the middle scenario. This is a more drastic scenario based on fuel burning trends that were already beginning to show themselves in the 1980s. So we start from the same point again, the yeah. cross, and draw a straight line finishing at 3.5 degrees on the 2100 axis again. Yep, that's it. Good. End the line halfway between 3 and 4 on the 2100 axis.
Okay. 3.5. Wow, that's quite a rise. But you said that was the middle scenario. What's the upper one?
Well, it's almost unbelievable, Sam. Start at 1980 and mm-hmm. zero again. We'll now yep. draw a line straight up to where 5 degrees meets 2050 on the scale.
Okay, 2050. There's 2020, the midpoint must be 2040, so halfway between 2040 and 2060 there. You're saying that by 2050 the temperature may have risen by 5 degrees?
Absolutely right.
That's really scary.
Yeah. Mm. This upper scenario is predicting an increase at about the rate of 0.7 every decade, or 10 years.
Right.
So can you just note that figure in the space given to the right of the graph?
Okay.
0.7 degrees.
Yeah. What about the other scenarios, Rachel? What kind of increase do they involve?
Well, the middle scenario is based on a predicted 0.3 degree rise per decade.
Yeah.
And the lower one, 0.04 degrees. Oh, hang on, you've missed out a zero for that last one.
Oh, yeah. What should we put on the second graph?
An even more alarming line, I'm afraid.
No.
This, as you can see from the title, shows the amount of ice in the northern hemisphere every summer.
Right.
The y-axis shows what the extent of the sea ice is in million square kilometres.
Yeah.
While the x-axis shows the year again. Okay. Begin drawing your line at 11 on the vertical axis. That means 11 million square kilometres of ice, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you would have found around the North Pole and Greenland between the summers of 1870 to 1910.
Mm.
From 1910, the sea ice began to rise, so that in 1950 it had actually gone up to 12 million square kilometres.
Okay.
There, put a cross at the point where 12 meets 1950. From this point on, though, the combustion engine and the rapid industrialization of the world has led to higher summer temperatures and a corresponding steady decrease in the amount of sea ice.
Mm.
Now, put a cross on the horizontal axis at 2070, there, right above the year itself, and draw a line down across the graph from 1950 to 2070 at zero.
Okay.
That's when we figure there won't be any summer ice left at all.
That is scary. So, how do we save the human race?
Good question. Well, first of all, from the perspective of those who believe in Gaia, we should go nuclear.
Go nuclear?
Oh, yes. No other forms of power will be able to satisfy our needs as safely and as efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And next, we should drink the oceans.
Drink the oceans.
Oh, yes. Seawater is our salvation. We've mentioned the droughts and shortages of fresh water. So we have to take the salt out of the sea with desalination plants and make it drinkable.
Mm.
Now, thirdly, we need to grow synthetic food. Oh, that's synthetic, Chris.
That's a bit slow,
yeah. Chris. Well, that just means not produced naturally.
You mean like sort of GM food?
Yeah, sort of, yes. The food needs to provide the maximum in nutrition for the smallest yield.
Okay, and then?
Then we need to prepare for chaos.
Mm-hmm.
For chaos?
Yeah, for chaos. C-H-A-O-S. But what do you mean by chaos and how do we prepare for it?
Well, coastal regions, Hong Kong included, will perish as the sea level rises. Other countries will be devastated by droughts. People will die, and there will be millions of environmental refugees.
Gosh.
Survivors will move north to cooler climates. And that leads us to a further piece of advice designed to save the human race.
What's that?
Well, engineer the climate.
Yes, we have to fix the climate by whatever means we can.
Can you give us an example?
Well, let's take plankton. You know what plankton is?
Yeah, it's tiny organisms in the sea that fish feed on.
That's right. Anyway, they feed on carbon dioxide. So if we can pump more plankton into the sea, they can help stabilise the climate.
Oh, right.
Above all, and you can put this down as a last point, We have to change our mindset. I mean, change our way of thinking.
In what ways?
Well, we need to question some of the more conventional environmental beliefs and decide if they favour the planet's survival. We ought to devote more time to human beings and less to protecting endangered animals like the Sumatran tiger or the last panda. Nature may have determined that they're not meant to survive.
Yes,
yeah.
Time to die. But for a few humans, with sensible planning and new respect for the Earth, time enough.
Yeah, we can make things easier for ourselves. Well, for example, by storing supplies for the future.
That's right, yes. And we should think about how else we're going to feed ourselves. Organic farming requires too much space and yields too little to feed the masses. It may not be the best thing for the human race at present.
Mm.
We need to think of ways to increase food production while reducing farm space so forests can grow again. We need to return farmlands to the forest.
Oh, okay, well, that's about all we have time for at the Gaia Vision Exhibition. I do hope you feel it's been worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks for coming, folks. Gaia may sound like an alternative view of the environment at the moment, but all too soon, it's likely to become a mainstream one.
I certainly found it an eye-opener. I don't think I'll ever be able to sleep easily again.
Oh, dear.
But the Gaian predictions are actually quite reassuring if you think about them. They may sound a bit gloomy, but they also acknowledge that the human race isn't stupid. It'll find some way of surviving.
But how can you be so positive, Sam?
Well, I guess you could say I'm just an optimistic kind of Gaia.
Oh, dear.
That's the end of part three. You'll now have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers. Keep your earphones on until you hear the announcement at the end of the 10 minutes. That's the end of the test. Stop writing now and put down your pencil. Close your question answer book and leave it on the desk in front of you for the invigilator to collect.